Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Frontside Podcast, episode 56. I am Charles Lowell, a developer here at the Frontside. With me is Jeffrey Cherawati, also a developer here at the Frontside.
Hey, y'all.
And we're going to be talking today with Philip Poots, who is a fantastic individual who I have known over the Twitters, over the emails, interacted with at conferences, seen him speak on at least one occasion. And today we're actually going to be talking about the thing that I saw him speak at Wicked Good Ember last June. And it was actually one of my favorite talks from that conference. It was on Elm for Ember developers. So thank you very much for being on the show, Philip. And why don't you tell us a little bit about what Elm is and how you came to find out about it and really kind of dive deeply into it.
Yeah, sure. So first of all, pleasure to be on the show. The Frontside is one of my favorite podcasts, if not my favorite, given the cross-section of the dad cast, the love of programming and balancing that with the business of programming. So that's right. I'm an independent developer. I started off with Rails, then got into Ember quite early on. And last year, I think around January, that's when I started really investigating Elm in detail. And it's actually a funny story how that came about, because I was at Ember Amsterdam, and it was a night where we had three members of the core team. We had Eric Brin gave a talk, Alex Machnier gave a talk, and Igor also came over because he's based in Europe. And Alex, he always loves to investigate new things, and one of the things he was getting into was observables. I'd never heard about observables at all. So after the talk, I kind of pulled him aside and I asked him some very stupid questions. And, you know, he was gracious enough to bear with me and to dive a little deeper into this stuff. And, you know, Alex, he's kind of a quiet member of the core team, unless he's got his drumsticks. But he's the guy that rewrote the router. And, you know, that was no mean feat, because I got into Ember just before that moment. And the way he managed to make that incredibly easy was fantastic. So you know, I kind of had an extra ear open to what he had to say. And so I kind of went down this observables hole. You know, you start off with React. That was the framework that was using observables the most. That brought me to Cycle.js.
Cycle.js. I haven't heard of that. Is Cycle.js a framework built on top of observables?
It is. Cycle.js. So there's a guy called Andre Stultz, or Andre Medeiros, but he uses Stultz as his name. So it's largely based off the same principles as React. So Cycle, basically, one of his inspirations, or at least one of the things which Cycle is most like, was the Elm architecture. You know, he calls it model view intent. You know, we have model view controller, and Elm, it was, you know, model update view, but essentially the same principles. And, you know, I'm the kind of guy that likes to get stuck in, to go deep. And, you know, where I started with observables, then I ended up at Elm. And, you know, I started playing around with it. I started looking into it, and I loved what I saw. You know, it was just, and the thing above all that really attracted me to it was the pure simplicity of what was going on. It was almost like they'd boiled down, you know, the UI paradigm to its essence and removed all the extra cruft, and you just saw what you meant, what you wanted. And it gave you these, you know, what I thought at the time, composable way to put things together.
Can we like unpack that just a little bit? Like, so I really love that idea of it boiled it down to the essence of UI. And so I assume there are, you know, there are certain coordinating mechanisms that Elm employs. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, to hear you say that Cycle.js used Elm as an inspiration. I also understand that Redux is inspired also by the Elm architecture. So yeah, I'm very curious, what are those kind of essential mechanics that so drew your attention?
Yeah, certainly. So I think you can look at it from two points of view. And the first is, you know, which I didn't actually learn until later, but the first is, you know, it's essentially boiling down functional programming. You know, you're decoupled, you're using functions, and not only functional programming, but also, and there's a lot of arguments over this term, but functional reactive programming. So the idea of functional programming is stateless, therefore time, you know, is kind of the beast that you have to deal with. But FRP then essentially boils time into the concept of values that can change over time. So you have a reference to one value, but that, you know, and that's what in, you know, in JavaScript, that's an observable. In Elm, in the beginning, you know, when I was getting into it, that was signals. That's now all kind of hidden underneath, so you don't really need to get over that conceptual hurdle anymore. And then the boiling down to the essence, I guess that's more from a code point of view. You know, with Ember, especially at the beginning, there were, you know, a ton of different concepts that were thrown at you to begin with. You know, it was billed as an MVC framework. It was sold as an MVC framework. But, you know, you had helpers in there. You had components. You had views, model, controller. You had this cluster of things. And you could see MVC in there. Mm-hmm. But there were enough things surrounding it to kind of think, oh, well, where does this piece of code go? Where does that piece of code go? Where should I do this?
There were a lot of blog posts trying to explain what exactly is the view. Is the template the view? Is the, you know, the controller the view?
What's like, the difference between a view and a controller?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So the way I think about frameworks is they give you buckets to put your code. And, you know, the buckets are kind of all connected together. So, and I'm thinking at a really simplistic level. I need to write this feature. Okay, I need this bit of code. I need this bit of logic. Where do I stick it? A framework says you should stick it here or you should stick it there. It solves the need of having to think about the broader architecture and how things interact because those things have been solved for you. Now, with Elm, it was just so straightforward to see, okay, this goes here, all the data, the model, it lives in this record, which is it's equivalent to a JavaScript object, we can say, on a simple level. Anything you need to do with state happens there. And then you've got the view, and the view is simply a function which takes that data structure, and then you tell it how to render it to HTML. And then all kind of the action, everything that happens in your application is also defined in one place in your update function. And that's it. Like no more than you need and no less than you need.
Yeah, I love that. It's almost, I feel like it is very much that's data down, actions up, kind of boiled down to the essence. It's almost better at that paradigm than Ember is itself with having your view is just a function. Your state transition or your update is just a function. And then your model is just kind of unadorned data. That's all it is.
And the type system as well in Elm also made it really straightforward. My model is a record. That's it. Mm-hmm. You know, my view is HTML in the beginning, but then it moved to HTML, which contains messages. And that's essentially, okay, I've got HTML, and in the HTML, there are events or actions, and those actions will send messages. Mm-hmm. Really straightforward. And then the update function, okay, I take in the current model, I take in the message, and I decide via pattern matching what I want to do. That's like boiled down. There are a few extra bits and pieces around there, but that's the essence of it.
So now, and when you say messages, I'm thinking this is a way of declaring what actions you will take when certain HTML elements, like events happen, like you're kind of declaratively mapping an event to the dispatch of an action.
That's correct, yes. And with any extra data, so a message is itself. So the actions, like the actions hash in Ember, essentially, mm-hmm. Along with the parameters for that action, mm-hmm. which would, you know, live in which you'd pass in through the HTML.
Mm-hmm. Some might argue that, you know, if something is simple to get something working, right? I can have a pure function that's a view. I can have a simple data structure, which is my model. I can have a pure function, which is, you know, my update or my state transition. So, you know, how I change my data or affect changes to the model. Some might say, well, that's very simple, but simple is great for simple cases. But then there's the question of scalability. As my application becomes more complex and as the interactions become more complex, does that simple paradigm actually scale? You know, what has been your experience there?
Straightforward answer. It's a learning curve to scale. Why? Because it's so new, and also because the things that you would have reached for in the past aren't available to you. Mm-hmm. So when I think of Ember scaling, you know, Ember, like the scale is built into the framework. You need another component, you just add another component. You need another model, you add another model. You need it, so there's a clear story or there's a clear way that you deliver a new feature. And I think that's a great, you know, a fantastic aspect of Ember where, that you also see now. You know, I can remember being at Wicked Good Ember and just realizing how many of the people that were speaking and how many of the people that I was talking to, you know, worked for bigger companies. And they were, you know, Heroku Dashboard, you had LinkedIn. And the fact that Ember scales across a large team size, you know, is a real testament to where Ember's going, which is slightly different for the reason why I got into Ember. And also, you know, I hit a few issues just on a side project with a friend. You know, the pace of Ember's change meant that, you know, when you only have a limited time to devote to the project, then you don't want to be spending that time figuring out where you should be in terms of the upgrade process, etc. So that's a known path. And I think that's a really clear advantage of Ember over Elm, is that the path in Elm, you know, is not as well fleshed out. And there's a bit of tension between, you know, Elm as a single page application and then Elm as an application that you stick on every page of your server generated app, for example. And the main people who use Elm, No Red Ink, who employ Evan Chaplicky, the creator of Elm, you know, their app at the minute is a Rails app with, you know, I think an Elm app for every page. I believe that that certainly was the case. Whether that still is the case, I don't know. And it's not an area where it's like, here's the path, go for it. Because the scalability of Elm, everyone came into Elm thinking, okay, I know React, I know Ember, the component system, data down, actions up. And, you know, in React, you're really encouraged to make a component for like the smallest thing on the page is a component. And then you have container components and you make your way out of the onion skin and hope you don't cry on the way. But the thing about Elm was everyone jumped in and tried to do it this way. And actually, I certainly got the impression when I was beginning that the Elm architecture was infinitely nestable, Russian doll style. And it is in a way, but the difficulty is then passing, you know, it's intercomponent communication between parent and child. And people had been figuring out weird ways with signals to do it that then became obsolete. So the main encouragement is basically go so far with a single component that you can. And then once you hit problems, try not to create new components or new bits of UI, but to extract the bits that you need into modules. And this is actually one of the things that really attracted me to Elm, is that you're encouraged to lean on your programming skill set rather than learning a whole new framework's way of doing things. So that the things that work in functional programming will work in Elm. But that's also a downside, because all of a sudden you actually have to to exercise your programming chops. And let's be honest, I mean, a lot of the stuff we're building, we're like, we're gluing things together. We're not thinking up new architectures or ways of doing things. So that's definitely a learning curve, and that's definitely a struggle, or something that I find difficult.
Yeah, I feel like that touches a lot on, you know, kind of the messages you get from like the FP community. I know certainly in the interactions I've had with the Clojure community, you know, that they're very big on that. It's like, let's have very powerful primitives. They have that term decomplecting, where it's like, let's get at the core. Let's like understand that essence. And so if we can compose, if we can enable composition, you know, of these kind of low level functions and allow you to compose the data, then you don't have to worry so much about, you know, everything else. There will be a way. I think the counterpoint to that is that you end up with a lot of different ways, because there are a lot of different ways that you can compose a very small set of primitives.
Yeah, that's right. But I think one of the advantages that Elm has over maybe other FP languages is that it tries, and this is where the similarity with Ember comes in as well. It tries very much to cement simple convention, but not only by convention, but actually bake it into the language. You know, so people who are coming from more powerful programming, functional programming languages, often come to Elm and think, well, why can't I do that? Why do I have to write all this boilerplate code? And the reason is because then it's not going to be simple enough anymore for people to use it. And also the goal of Elm, which is, you know, this long-term maintainability with big of large code bases, you know, you kind of shoot yourself in the foot a bit, just like you said, Charles.
Yeah, I think that's actually a great point. And it's actually one of the things that was most memorable, I think, about your talk at WikiGood was, let me just a quick anecdote. I remember like in 2007, when the iPhone came out, I had an iPhone, and my father-in-law came over from Finland. And this is like, you know, this is a guy who was a Nokia partisan. Right. I mean, part of like Finnish pride, was like everybody owned. Exactly. Everybody owned a Nokia mobile phone, you know, so he came over, he visited me. I had an iPhone and he was like, oh, can I see it? And, you know, he took it, you know, had the swipe to unlock, and he like swiped it and it unlocked and all the app icons just kind of came right into the screen. He was like, I want one. that was all it took. I've never seen a sales process so utterly complete and so rapid in its realization. And for me, I think that moment when I saw your talk was when you made a mistake, like where you had actually, you were, you know, I think you had passed, like you were trying to match against an improper attribute on the model inside the update function. And, you know, first of all, the first thing that happened was that Elm caught it before you could even compile your program. And the error was just beautiful. It put its finger right on it. It's like, you need to fix this, like right here. And so there's so much like tied up into that, because I feel like it addresses a lot of the learning curve problems that we have in Ember.
And I don't think that's Ember specific either.
No, it's not.
That's a JavaScript thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
In many ways, I think of JavaScript as a very low level substrate. You know, it's like sand. It's very granular, and it's very hard to put together well without falling apart. Mm-hmm. Whereas Elm gives you bigger blocks, so to speak, but it also defines a way through the type system where if you don't put those blocks together in the right way, it's going to tell you.
Right.
And that's why, despite some of the ignorance of how best to do Elm apps, that's why people continue to use it, because it gives them this delightful experience.
Yeah. Yeah. It was fantastic, where when you fail, it picks you up, dusts you off, and sets you right back on the right track. And I think that, one, that's just a freaking awesome feature. And I think also, too, the thing that struck me when I saw that was like, wow, this community has a different focus than other like FP communities that I've come into contact with, because I have encountered that exact same error message in Haskell, and it left me puzzling and wondering what to do. It's like, no instance for type class, blah, 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 for class, blah. And then, you know, if you're an experienced Haskeller, it does point right to the problem, in the same way that, like, if you've learned to parse Perl stack traces, you see a Perl stack trace and you say, you understand it. But, you know, they could have gone that way with Elm. But the other thing that it demonstrated, yeah, is kind of a different focus there.
Absolutely. And that really comes down to Evan Shaplicki, the creator of Elm. And I was able to get over to London in October a couple of years ago, well, a year and a half ago now, to do a workshop with him at the Code Mesh conference. And you know, just seeing him teach this stuff and seeing him go into this and talk about things in a bit more detail, like, it was very clear, first of all, that he'd had, you know, a negative experience picking up Haskell, I think it was. And he just thought, it doesn't have to be this hard. Like, the things aren't actually that hard. It's the way that we're explaining them that makes it hard. The things are actually under the surface really simple. So, he has a blanket ban on this kind of technical jargon in the Elm community. He prefers to give things really straightforward names. I think he said to me that one of his thesis advisors or his university professors said, you know, Evan, is what you get when you put a usability specialist into a programming language creator's shoes. That he does have this dual focus where he understands the benefits of, you know, static type systems, but he also deeply cares about the experience of not only picking up the language and learning it, but also the day-to-day use of it. And you know, that's something that just shines through. And I think, you know, even if Elm never makes it into the pantheon of great programming languages, like, that in itself and the influence that that's had already on other communities is just fantastic for it. You know, it's the tide that lifts all boats in many ways, and we all benefit from that.
Mm-hmm. We kind of touched on this a little bit earlier. We've been talking about the ergonomics of being an engineer working with Elm or Ember. What about the business case? We've mentioned how Ember has proven to scale fairly well in large organizations. What's Elm's path to being able to do that? And where's the niche that it fits in right now?
Yeah, certainly. So I definitely think, you know, Ember comes out of Apple, I believe, with Sprite Core. So, I mean, that's where it started. And it's interesting to see that that's also, you know, where it's gone in terms of the focus is making it easy to build these rich applications. I think also that Elm has a similar genesis in the sense that Evan, I believe he did an internship at Microsoft and one at Google. And I think there's a conference talk as well from, you know, large JS or MLOC or something, millions of lines of code. So it's definitely gunning for the same area, which is applications which are large and hairy, and trying to make the maintainability a lot better by bringing the strengths of the static type system to bear and bring the simplicity that enables. And, you know, that means that the learning curve maybe is a little sharper at the beginning, in a similar way also that Ember was and is. But then you should reach this point where the maintainability of the app outweighs, you know, the time spent in learning. I think about it a bit like test-driven development. You know, I remember back when I was doing Rails and DHH had baked TDD into Rails itself, and there was the years of the testing discussions, whether to test all the time, test everything, 100% coverage, or even, you know, full circle tests are a waste of time. But it's a similar philosophy in that, you know, if the tests are doing what they should be doing, which is giving you great feedback, the time it takes to get up to speed in testing, the time it takes to set up testing, the time it takes to write the test, they pay off, you know, further down the line. And that's not music to the ears of the people who want to get something into production immediately, but it's definitely music to the ears of people who, you know, will be spending a long time on maintenance in an application. You know, the No Red Ink application, you know, is huge. They have millions of users. They build software for, I think, teaching grammar in schools in the US. And yeah, they talk all the time about the benefits of Elm, mainly in the sense of confidence. I have the confidence to go in and change this code. You know, we all have bits or majorities of our code base, which are things that we'd rather not like to touch. You know, we kind of section them off. You know, if a feature request comes in, instead of, you know, saying, yeah, we can do that, you try and slowly push it out the door. So Elm is supposed to give you then the confidence to be able to go to any part of your code base and to change it without the fear that you're going to break something or break everything, because the type system, the compiler will tell you, oh, you know, you changed this type, you changed the signature of this function, here's where it's broken. And as soon as you fix the compiler errors, you know, functionally it works. I mean, you'd probably have a few tests to test the actual business logic of it rather than necessarily the technical stuff. But it's a huge time saver. And, it, you know, that's where we want to be as developers in our relationship with our tools, right? We don't want to be fearing our tools. We don't want to be anxious every time we open our editor. You know, we don't want to fear the feature request coming in. You know, we want to be in control of our environment, and we want to be able to, you know, deliver the business value. And I think, you know, that's certainly the promise of Elm. That's certainly where it wants to be.
Yeah. No, I love that. It sounds like that is where they want to shoot for, is these big applications, and they do want to scale massively. So let me ask the question then, where is Elm, do you think, right now today on that curve of scalability?
Yeah, certainly. So, you know, to put it in Ember terms, that's maybe the best way I can describe it. If anyone remembers the early days of Ember, you know, I definitely feel that they're in 0.9 approaching 1 rather than later than that. And one of the things as well, I think it's important to note, is that Evan is not rushed. It blew my mind when I heard him speak about it. And, you know, it wasn't anything big he said or anything, but just the whole kind of tenor of the conversation, of the way he was teaching, of how he was talking about Elm, was so in contrast to like the JavaScript hype machine. Mm-hmm. So in contrast to a new framework every month. You know, he was like, if Elm is going to be around in 10 years, then this is the decision that I'm going to make.
Right.
And so in that sense, where is Elm on that journey? I'd say it's still pretty early on. I'd say also Evan is really focused on use cases. So if there's not a use case for something, there's no reason to add it. Mm-hmm. For example, you know, this is actually quite frustrating maybe for people who are coming out of, you know, a JavaScript ecosystem, and, you know, they think of a feature that they want and they submit a pull request and it just gets closed, or it gets set, you know, is there a use case for this? Why do you need it? Is this generalizable to everyone? You know, will it make sense to add this to the language? Can you do it in a library now and then, mm-hmm. you know, figure it out later? Can you do it in JavaScript with ports instead of like having to bring it into Elm? So he's definitely, you know, building it very slowly. But, you know, that may sound like the downside right now, but the upside is, you know, we're going to come out with something at the end, hopefully, that is battle tested, that fits the use case. A good example of that was the URL handling, the navigation. Right. You know, it didn't live in Elm. You know, it was, well, do we actually need it? Because, you know, who's building single page applications? Can you give me your experiences? There were a couple of libraries also built. Mm-hmm. And then the things from those libraries were then taken in, you know, a little bit like Ember as well, where you use the add-on ecosystem to kind of trial new things, and then things may get brought into core or may get kind of the official stamp of approval. But it's a lot slower and not as committee-based, more, you know, Evan is the benevolent dictator for life.
I really like that approach. I don't withhold my opinion from like the benevolent dictator versus kind of the oligarchy that you see elsewhere. But I think I was thinking as you were describing it that maybe, you know, the framework really, and this is me, I'm kind of a little bit of a tree nerd, mostly in and around the trees that grow in Central Texas, but I love trees. And unfortunately, it sounds like oak or maybe redwood would have been like a more appropriate name because those are very slow growing, have a very hard wood, whereas an elm is actually fairly short lived and has a softer wood.
And you also don't want cedar because that will come back and bite you immediately. Yeah. Highly allergic and toxic to humans.
Right. So named elm, but slow growing hardwood that you can build a house out of. But yeah, I like that. I like that. It's so important to get things right the first time because that's where you realize exponential gains. Unfortunately, there is no substitute for exponential gains rather than deep thought. At least that's been my experience. Like there's just no, you can realize gigantic short-term gains with taking cut corners, but in terms of long-term exponential, ultimately, you know, those will taper off.
Yeah. And I think as well, what we've seen in Ember's experience is the decisions that you take, you know, to open up a private API or not to make something private, you know, they limit you because all of a sudden everyone starts using those APIs. You know, a year down the line, you realize, oh, hang on, we don't want to design it in this way. We want to do it in that way. But now, you know, given the commitment that Ember has to stability, you know, you have to deal with that. And sometimes the dealing with that actually takes more energy, more time, more effort, you know, in education, in actual code, in maintaining two branches, all of that kind of stuff then takes away from the time that you could have had to think up better solutions. And it's a danger, you know, it's almost like as soon as you, you know, you throw this into the water, that it becomes firm, you know, as soon as you throw it into the crowd will take it and they will use it. And your chance to change it or mold it will have gone. And I think that's all, you know, Evan talks a lot with language designers. At least I got that impression that he opens up channels of communication with people who've done this before. And he thinks very deeply. I mean, so one of the things is, you know, he's not closed off to the idea of adding more powerful features to Elm, but he would only do it when it's right to do it. So it's not just, is this feature right? But it's, is this the right time for this feature? And that as well is just, you know, it's the kind of mind-blowing, like, who thinks about this stuff? Who cares about this stuff?
Yeah, because certain features become accessible once other features are in place. Like, just to use, I feel like it would have been as feasible to have an entire, like, compiled language as an acceptable option before people started, you know, transpiling CoffeeScript. And then with Babel, you know, transpiling future versions of JavaScript back into JavaScript. Whereas, you know, if those intermediate steps happened, if CoffeeScript and Babel would have happened, would people be as receptive to things like Elm or things like PureScript? So yeah, it's definitely, there's kind of the zeitgeist of the development community really informs what features are even possible or appropriate tomorrow, even though they might have some objectively sound qualities about them.
You want to make sure they're not too far ahead of their time.
Right, exactly. Folks got to be ready for it. So then the other thing that I wanted to ask was, given the trajectory of where Elm is, you know, some people are using it in production. You said it was around like a 0.910. You know, if we are actually quite happy with our current code bases, whether we're using Ember, whether we're using React, whether we're using, you know, some other framework, what are things that you can learn from Elm that you can bring home with you to your own town, wherever that is, to use and make your own life better as you develop code, to kind of increase that confidence, as you say?
Yeah, certainly. So, I mean, and this is very relevant to my situation because the past couple of months, you know, I haven't had a chance to do any Elm. But what I've found is after kind of my deep dive, I've come out the other end and I feel like I've come out a better programmer. I feel like Elm is, you know, simple enough conceptually to learn quicker, faster, you know, at least, you know, the basics more than maybe even a JavaScript framework. And I think that the things that you will learn in that process are tremendously beneficial, even if you don't ever end up using Elm in a professional capacity. So the thing I think that grabbed me most is, because of the way the type system is, you have to deal with every error. And this is something which in my, you know, when writing Ruby or when writing Ember, you know, you always focus on the happy path. And then once you got the happy path in place, often the business will say, okay, that's done. Let's move on. And, you know, your better instincts say, well, no, we haven't actually made this robust enough. But sometimes the value is also, you know, not that great in kind of shoring up all those cases. But what Elm does, because of the way it's built, is it forces you to deal with failure. You know, the classic no runtime errors in production. You know, the reason that is, it may have taken you a bit longer to write your code in Elm, but you come out of it with a confidence that if something explodes, it's either something incredibly rare or it was JavaScript and not Elm. And just the forcing, okay, it's like, well, okay, how can I think better about how this code can fail? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a bit of extra mental effort when you do it in a language that's not Elm, but it's definitely something that's worth doing, you know, if you want to build good software. Another thing related to the failure stuff is just the idea of a maybe, the idea of what's called an abstract data type or a union type or an enum, like the fact that you can encode like different states in one object and that you deal with all of those states in a cohesive way. So one of the things, actually, I think it was Jack Franklin of JavaScript Playground who brought this back from Elm into JavaScript was, you know, when you have a screen, you want to load some data via AJAX or fetch. Instead of just loading the page, sending off the request, getting the request back, deciding what to do with it, it's like, well, why don't we encode those states in our code? So we have the waiting state, we have the found state, but we have found, but it was an error, we have found and it worked, we have found and it actually has no values. So instead of just dealing up with those on the fly, if statements, etc., like why don't you create an object that encodes the states that your UI can be in, and then, you know, you react and the UI will know what to do based on this, you know, you'll write the code to do that. But in some ways, you, at least to me, that's a lot better than kind of hit and hope.
Yeah.
Oh, we got an error. Let's if do this, if do that. Let's nest some callbacks or let's chain some promises or, you know, just the sheer act of taking a step back. And this is something Elm forces you to do because of the way it is, like thinking about the domain and thinking about how best to model the domain. I mean, to be honest, this is probably just good programming practice, but how often do we not do it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It seems so obvious, except it's only obvious when you're put into a system that you can't slide on it. So like,
yep.
It reminds me, what you're describing reminds me of this concept that I came across in the Haskell community. They talk about wholemeal solutions versus piecemeal solutions. And,
right.
You know, most of the time they talk about wholemeal solutions as kind of finding the most general set of abstractions that solve a problem for all cases. But I hadn't like applied it to this concept of like, yeah, the all of the potential states, like kind of envisioning your application, you know, as you execute your code, you'll only come across one state at a time, but kind of thinking of your code as all of these sort of quantum states of your application existing at once. And you need to like account for them all and draw that whole picture.
Yeah. So this is a really stupid analogy, but I don't know if anyone's played Age of Empires or any other kind of war-based game where you have a map, you've got the fog of war, and you can only see, you know, what's a few kind of meters around you, and you have to send out your scouts, you need to find them. You know,
yeah,
there's
different
tactics. Either you shore up your base and you concentrate on where you are, or you send your scouts to the far ends of the map. And in terms of like that seeking out of the unknown, like I feel like Elm forces you to know the map.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when I'm programming in JavaScript or in Ruby, it's more like, okay, I'm here. I need to do this. I do it. And you don't necessarily force yourself to think of all the potential states or all the potential things that can happen, the events that can happen. Whereas with Elm, if you don't have those, then it will shout, it will tell you,
oh, man.
Get those things in place.
Yeah, no, I love that analogy. Like actually send out your scouts and know the map.
Yeah. And I think as a person, and this is maybe why it appeals to me, is like, I like the feeling that I haven't left a stone unturned.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like shipping something that I'm confident in and that I know won't bite me. Or if it does bite me, it's purely because it was an unknown. You know, it's like doing your due diligence. You know, as I'm saying this, you know, Elm is not the silver bullet. Elm is not the panacea. Elm will not solve all your problems. But, you know, speaking in terms of contrast with JavaScript or Ruby and more dynamic languages and then Elm, you know, these are the things that happen. And I think that kind of leads me on to another point, which is you know, Evan in the mailing list conversations and in the decisions that he takes with Elm. You know, it's, I don't know if this is stages of maturity as a developer, but, you know, you find your tool, you love it. It's the only thing that can do the job. And then, you know, you realize, oh, well, other people are doing jobs pretty well doing their other stuff. So, you know, I guess each to their own. But I feel like there's another stage where it's like, what are the trade-offs involved in taking this decision or using this tool? And what are the trade-offs involved in taking this decision or using that tool? And just the way of thinking in terms of trade-offs instead of absolutes, I find really, really valuable. And that's definitely something that I've been able to apply. You know, what are the benefits of this decision? And not only, you know, from a code point of view, but from an organizational point of view, from a team point of view, from a long-term point of view, from a short-term point of view, like having a wider arena to make those decisions, you know, has been really helpful for me, valuable.
Yeah.
Outside of Elm.
No, I can see it. I believe you. And I think that I would like, because I think we're coming to the end of our time here, I think I'm going to make the same recommendation that I made to everybody last week when we were talking with Torin about Redux. And that is, you should go out and you should try Elm. Like, it's really easy to get started. And it will guide you. The guides are excellent. The error handling is excellent. And yes, it is quirky and weird, but it supports you. So it's, you know, it definitely gives you, you know, there's going to be some big functional programming boulders thrown at you, but like you, it gives you a mech suit to deal with them. So
I think you need to say a suit of armor so we can stick with the like
Age of Empires.
Before we don't want to switch too many.
Yeah. Like go out there, try it, like experience, you know, the things that Philip is talking about, because I feel like they are very real and they will have a good effect on you. Whatever it is that you do the next day or the next week or the next month.
They'll challenge the way you think. They'll give you a new perspective and they'll give you a good counterpoint as well. You know, Elm is not for everyone, but only if you try it will you understand that. And, you know, I think that's one of Evan and everyone in the Elm community is, you know, try it yourself. You know, I'm not going to say Elm is right for you. Elm is right for your business. You know, rewrite everything in Elm. Not at all. Try it out. Try it out in a side project. Try it out just having fun hacking around. And if you do want to make the jump to, you know, using it in your company or whatever, don't like take a decision to rewrite everything. You know, take one very small part of your app and do it in Elm and see how it goes. Because, you know, if you don't like it, you can take it out. If it works, you can build another small thing. You know, this kind of gradual approach, this, we're far too quick to jump on a bandwagon, you know, trash the old thing, do the new thing.
Yeah.
And in reality, especially now when, you know, we are building applications that are going to be maintained, when we are building applications that are going to be around for a few years, you know, it's also just not feasible and sometimes it's not right.
Yeah.
So you just got to make that decision, you know, maturely rather than I want to use this or I want to use that.
Right.
Which can be tough, but
right,
ultimately you want to deliver the value. And yeah, so try Elm, elmlang.org/try. You can try it in the browser and see how you go. The official guide is really good. There's also elmtutorial.org, which is kind of a complement to the official guide. Pragmatic Studio have released recently a updated course for learning Elm. James Moore, knowthen.com. He has a couple of Elm courses, one's free, introductory, and then there's a paid course which goes into deeper topics, whether text or whether video, whatever your thing is, there's resources available to get you to the point where, you know, you'll be able to make a decent decision.
Well, fantastic. I'm certainly excited. I haven't dipped my toes in Elm for a while, and I'm actually, after this conversation, pretty stoked to get on it again. So I hope everybody else does. Thank you so much, Philip, for coming on to the podcast. This was just a fantastic and enlightening conversation.
Not at all. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Well,
that's it from the front side. Remember to get in touch with us at frontside.io if you're interested in UI that's engineered to make your UX dreams come true.